Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Last week I began a conversation with Dr. Joseph Shaw, chairman of the Latin Mass Society and editor of a new book that defended the idea of the Protestant monarchy from a Catholic point of view. And this is the second half of that discussion. We decided to divide the conversation in two, partly because of the length of time that we spoke to one another, but also because the second half of the conversation contained some developed reflections on the state of the relationship between the papacy and the Church, since monarchy functions as one element in the different models of the papal office. During our conversation, Dr. Shaw suggested that over the last 100 years, the papacy has developed in a way that effectively means that it is out of control, and reflects on what that might mean for the state of the Church today and what the best responses to that might be. But before we resume that conversation, current events have caught up with us and overtaken us. For during the last few days in the upcoming biography of King Charles, reports have found their way into the press about Prince William and his own attitude to becoming defender of the faith, with the serious implications about the future of the monarchy and the Christian faith that flow from that. Charles Hardiman is a highly respected journalist and author, so when he chooses to reel intimacies in the royal family, it's because they're likely to have some serious significance in the way the royal family relates to the country. And so as he has been writing about the hesitations and anxieties that Prince William has, not about inheriting so much the burden of kingship, he's prepared for that, but the responsibility of being defender of a faith he does not have, the implications of this reach high on the constitutional Richter scale. It is, of course, to his credit that Prince William's conscience has been pricked, but we don't know exactly how worried William is. If he doesn't know it already, someone, probably in a suit, will quietly sidle up to him and tell him it's a non-negotiable part of the whole crown package. Why non-negotiable? Just because, despite the fact that people like to debate the disestablishment of the Church of England and the principle of a state church, it would take an army of lawyers 10 years to go back through all the spaghetti junction of 500 years of legislation and unpick the status of church and monarchy, where they lie like legal Siamese twins at the heart of Protestant constitutional history. What would be simpler and more manageable would be a referendum on becoming a republic and then abolishing the monarchy and making the Church of England fully independent. But this is clearly not something that any of the House of Windsor could either want, countenance or encourage. At one level, William may not have grasped that there is a difference between what he as a private, personal individual believes and the public role that he adopts as defined by the Constitution. If he were a committed atheist, the tension between his private values and his public persona might be stretched beyond breaking point. But if he were to be only cautiously agnostic, the fact that the monarch has no executive responsibility but only ceremonial choreography might allow him to bridge that gap. But what if it didn't? Wouldn't he then be faced with the prospect of having to step aside as the heir to the throne and allow the next in line to play the role he felt asked too much of his personal integrity? Would William be willing to sacrifice his royal identity and inheritance for his conscience? Only he knows the answer to those questions. Paradoxically, the weakness, though, of being a non-confessing church with low membership hurdles, as the Church of England is, becomes a strength for religious devotion and identity in society in general, and might make matters easier for the way in which he judged what integrity demanded of the way he played the role. For example, at her Diamond Jubilee in 2012, Queen Elizabeth II expressed the idea very well. She said, "The concept of our established church is occasionally misunderstood and, I believe, commonly underappreciated. Its role is not to defend Anglicanism to the exclusion of other religions. Instead, the Church has a duty to protect the free practice of all faiths in this country." Defender of the Protestant faith then becomes, by contextual extension, defender of the principle of faith, which is, of course, something like the view that Charles as king takes. And yet a hard-headed examination of this principle shows some awkward gaps in its practice. Because society and culture are beginning to change rapidly, The fact that the monarchy's responsibilities are largely cosmetic and ceremonial may work well when the cultural weather is balmy, but less so if the storm clouds gather. Christians are, in fact, becoming persona non grata in their own country. Jews are feeling increasingly unsafe in a rapidly changing context, where the increasing number and militancy of Muslims makes sharing the common public square a much more uncomfortable exercise. Progressive secularism at one end and an ever more muscular Islam at the other are placing both Jews and practicing Christians under pressure. If the role of the king as supreme governor of the state church and defender of the faith were to be an effective guarantor of the freedom of religious identity and expression for Christians and Jews, it's not clear how that does or would work. What has the king done for the Batley schoolteacher driven into permanent exile and hiding? What has the king done for Catholics arrested for standing on the pavement not far enough away from a closed abortion clinic, arrested only for thought crime on suspicion of praying? It was certainly the case that in the culture that Elizabeth II presided over as monarch, the existence of the established church did help support the normality of religion and the hospitality of the way in which it was exercised in a society with pluriform values. But that is all changing rapidly. Whatever difficulties the Catholic Church faces in the relationship between its 1.4 billion members and the Pope, the office of the papacy is exponentially stronger and more robust than any flaws the holder of the office might or might not have. But that's partly because the symbolism and the executive power of the office are seamlessly united. The role of supreme governor of the Protestant Church, bequeathed to his relatives and descendants by Henry VIII, high on symbolism, but after the 1688 Glorious Revolution, emptier of executive responsibility, cannot easily ride out the twin pressures of an agnostic king and the militant competition of wokery and Islam. And a vacillating, philosophically agnostic monarch, lacking conviction or ideological muscle, may help create a vacuum at the centre of our national life. So it may be that what Charles Hardiman has picked up in William's hesitation is not the dynamic of a personal discomfort about the gap between image and reality only, but maybe a far more astute instinct about the danger of a vacuum of faith at the centre of the state. The present gentle and civilised monarchical balancing act that holds the ring between different cultures may find that it lacks sufficient coherence if it is required to contain the stresses produced by more aggressive ideologies. The struggle for the soul of the country and the character of the public square may only have just begun, and William may eye his imminent inheritance with a sane and well-reasoned trepidation. And so, on that note, let's return to the conversation with Dr. Joseph Shaw and his reflections on the important implications of a Protestant monarchy for Catholics and members of other faiths, and then consider the way in which the papacy itself, with its own monarchical characteristics, has developed and is developing. Our culture is changing fast. Our political situation is changing fast. I mean, certainly some Christians have said, if you're any kind of defender of the faith, and we know that has a technical meaning that doesn't have much cash value. Of course we know that. But nonetheless, at this point, it is at the very least cosmetic. Christianity is in trouble in this country. The possibility of Parliament passing laws that prevents Christians standing on the pavement or the sidewalk in silence lest they appear to be praying is a development that many of us couldn't even have imagined a few years ago. So Parliament has, through delegation to local councils, passed some very draconian and anti-human, anti-democratic and above all anti-Christian laws. We're agreed that the king could certainly talk behind the scenes to ministers if he wanted to. If this is not the thin end of the wedge exactly, but if this is something that is simply developing and getting worse, and there's nothing to indicate that it's going to get better, given the way in which we live in a new pseudo-egalitarian culture, is there going to come a point when the stretch between the cosmetic and the symbolic and the value-infused pragmatism of repressive government become too great and break? I mean, is there going to come a point where the king as monarch has to say, this contradicts my relationship and the relationship of the monarchy with the state in a way that can't be endured. I mean, I see two particular crises coming. One is the way in which Islam demographically is going to grow exponentially in the next 50 years. The other is the way in which progressive ideas become increasingly draconian and anti-humanistic and anti-Christian. If you were king, would you be worried about the implications on your responsibilities in the body politic that these things represent?
Well, I don't have to be a king to worry about these things, I'm sure. We're all worried in our different ways. What's the point? I mean, so what? Of course he's worried. I mean, we're all worried, so we're kind of worrying and we're doing our small things to try and mitigate the problems. In his case, I think that his outreach towards Islam is unexpected. I mean, although we've been watching it for years now, but in itself, it's interesting, unexpected, and creative. I think it's very impressive that he's done that. It's not necessarily what I would have done. I might not have thought of it, but it's amazing that he's done it. Whether it's going to be successful in a large way or small, I don't know. But I think that's a very interesting example of the kind of thing that the king, Prince of Wales, when he started doing this, can do. And he has a way of doing it that is not available to anyone else. You know, when the Prince of Wales says, I want to have a conversation with some Muslim clerics, you know, things happen, and they have happened over many years. Let's hope that those sorts of initiatives have a ameliorating effect on the, you know, whatever crisis might arise from an increasingly mixed religious landscape. And obviously what he thought, and no doubt still thinks, is that if we're going to have a large body of Muslims, we've got to bring them inside the tent. And he's absolutely right. I mean, there's no good pretending, you know, or having had a war with them. I mean, they're here. You know, they're British citizens. You know, many of them are very respectable and good citizens. If there are particular problems with that, we need their help in dealing with those problems. So, in a way, I mean, maybe that's the answer to your question. Yeah, he worries. He does what the things specifically that he can do about it. Other people can do the things that they specifically can do. They will have a role in the great, you know, enterprise of living with one another.
No, thank you very much. That's a very cogent answer. I'm not sure I mean, of course, I agree with, it's not a matter of agreeing or disagreeing. You're quite right. One has to make as much virtue of the process as one possibly can. The outcome is a different matter. But in terms of people worrying, being chairman of the Latin Mass Society, it's not an enviable task just at this particular. How do you see the flourishing of the Latin Mass in a different monarchical regime at the moment? Is there anything you'd like to say about the prospects and responsibilities of those who value it as part of their own faithful tradition?
Well, I think there's an interesting parallel between the sacred monarchy that we have, that all countries with a constitutional monarchy have, and the other kind of sacred monarchy, which the Catholic Church has, and the importance, the role of symbols, ceremonies, and Pope Benedict's program of reviving the symbols of the papacy, so such as the red shoes, which are connected with his willingness to undergo martyrdom. And I'd say the same thing, well, many of the same things about the Pope that I would say about the King. Of course, the Pope is an executive monarch, and the case of the papacy as a executive monarchy of a quite extreme kind in on the scale of absolute to constitutional. He's pretty close to the other end of the scale from our king here in the UK. And you can see the problems that creates. I mean, it may be people's fantasy, Catholics' fantasy. Oh, how wonderful it would be to have an executive monarch who was kind of really kind of, well, we've got one. And look, where's that get you?
See how you like it, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Give me a bit of constitutional monarchy. Frankly, you know, let me bring back a kind of medieval situation in which kings and popes felt the limits of their power. Their power was limited by tradition.
Just briefly, is this a plea for conciliarism against ultramontanism?
No, it's not. No, not at all. Conciliarism was an attempt to solve a problem which created by an overactive papacy, where the traditions were no longer, or they felt to be no longer, capable of dealing with the problems. So a monarch of any kind indeed a hereditary aristocracy as well, they have their power, authority, their role in society from tradition. It's only because of tradition that we have a monarchy at all. It's only because of tradition that King Charles is king. And that should be, well, it is as a very clear message to the person who holds that position, that you tamper with tradition at your peril, because actually you're sawing off the branch you're sitting on. And that's, of course, that's exactly what the French monarchy did when it embraced absolutism. It soared right through the branch and it fell. And I feel that the modern papacy has done something very similar. The papacy is the apex of a whole structure of traditional institutions, of which the episcopacy is the most obvious. But there are many others, some dominical traditions going back to our Lord, some of them more recent have grown up. But it derives its prerogatives and its power and its prestige and its social role and its political heft from these traditions. And if you start cutting them all away, saying, oh, well, this is hampering my efforts to do this or that, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to accept the fact that your efforts are going to be hampered in some ways, because that's where you're getting your authority from. You cut through all those traditions, it will collapse, because they're holding it up. So we've had, I mean, it's not just Pope Francis. In fact, I think in some ways Pope Francis is a symptom rather than a cause. And I know I differ in this from many people. I'd agree about other things, but a whole lot of popes going back 100 years and more have been saying, oh, I don't really believe in the episcopate. I don't really believe in the autonomy of ordinary Catholics, of Catholic monarchs, of ordinary lay people. I'm just going to impose my personal ideas, regardless of tradition. And that's clear in the case of the liturgy, but it's also clear in the case of the canon law. A reform of canon law was one of the most anti-traditional things that happened in the church in the last 200 years, the Pio Benedictine Code of Canon Law. So what's the result of that? We have a papacy, a monarchy, which is out of control, literally out of control. There are no limits to what it can do. And no one can stop it. No one can appeal to it. No one can say, oh, well, hang on, look about this, this body of law. Look at these liturgical traditions. Look at the prerogatives of the bishops. None of that applies anymore. And that's given us the situation we have today.
That's extremely interesting. I mean, I'm used to, in the arguments along these lines, to blaming a certain sort of Peronist strain in the last 10 years. But I think the argument you make suggesting this goes back over 100 years is a compelling one. I mean, is there any solution in other monarchical and constitutional structures? We have equity and common law in this country. Is there nothing at all within Roman Catholicism that offers some form of equilibrium when the system runs too hot?
Well, what we have to have is a restoration of reverence for tradition, for the traditions of the papacy, for the traditions of the church, because these traditions place limits on not only papal power, but also the power to do harm of everyone in the church. So the parish priest who torments his congregation with liturgical abuses, the bishop who tyrannizes over his clergy, the Catholic lay person who doesn't ring up his family in the way which the church wants him to do. These are all happening because of a lack of respect for tradition. Now, it's not so easy to do that. And this is the great problem for counter-revolutionaries over the centuries. How do you put Humpty Dumpty back together again? And one answer to that question is pick up the tools of the enemy and use tyranny. Use concentration camps and the firing line and kill your enemies and establish. It's been tried, and actually it doesn't work. And that's something which is a very important lesson from the 20th century, which everyone's got to absorb. It doesn't work. It's very tempting. It may work in the short term, but actually, you look at it 50 years later, and has it seeped into the hearts of the people? Have you restored those traditional moral, political institutions? No, there's a terrible reaction, and actually things end up worse. than they were before. So the first thing you need to do in the Catholic context, which Pope Benedict did, is start restoring the respect for tradition in the liturgical sphere, the papacy's own traditions and so on. Now, he was doing that in a fairly small way, but it was something. It was something. And unfortunately, well, he abdicated, and that was one of the greatest blows against the traditions of the papacy, which is impossible to imagine. And I have to say, even now, and maybe I'll shock people by saying it, even now, I think it'd be a great mistake for Pope Francis to abdicate. I don't think there's any chance he'll do it, but I think it would be very bad if he did it, because we need the papacy to see itself as a sacred trust, not just as a job. That's very much part of the problem. It's not a job. It's a vocation. You leave it through death. You can't resign from being a husband or a father. You can't resign from being the Pope. I'd much rather have a Pope who is senile and, you know, in a bedroom hooked up and nothing was happening. Bring it on. Bring it on. Much rather 100 times over than a situation of a maniac who just wants to, you know, impose his will on an institution which is elected him for a certain period of time. I mean, it's anyone who thinks that would be preferable. They need to wake up and smell the coffee. So this isn't something restoration of this profound respect for tradition which we have in our ancestors, our Catholic predecessors of more than 100 years ago, the early modern, the medieval kind of attitude. It's not something that can be done in a moment, but it's something which is necessary. And the idea that the papacy, as Pope Benedict expressed it, is a servant of tradition, not the master. That's the key idea. The papacy, of course, everyone else as well. You know, the episcopacy, the bishops, general councils, when they occur, individual Catholics. We are guided by the tradition. We have to interpret it, of course. We have to apply it to new circumstances. But we don't simply say, oh, I like this bit of the tradition. Yeah, I think I'll use that. But no, not that other bit. That is the death of the church as a human institution.
I didn't expect a theology of the papacy to have to shed such an incisive light on the political situation that we face with the monarchy in this country. And it's often said in psychotherapy that the last 10 minutes are the time when all the real gold comes out. Joseph, you've really given us a fantastic conclusion to this. I'm so grateful, because there's a great deal to think about here. And although you and I ourselves have no executive power, the ideas and the theology and the philosophy that you're expressing have a power of their own. And I hope they'll commend themselves to people who listen. Thank you very much for taking the time and trouble to have this conversation. It's been great to talk to you again, as always.
Thank you very much, Gavin. It's brilliant.